The State Affairs Committee will now come to order. Members, please be sure to speak into your mics during the roll call. And with that, Brenda, will you please call the roll?
Chair Masullo?
Here.
Representatives Altman? Bartleman?
Here.
Buchanan?
Here.
Chambliss?
Here.
Cheney?
Here.
Drake?
Yes.
Representative Drake?
Yes, here. Over here.
Representative Fisher?
Here.
Gia Lombardo?
Here.
Golf Marcel?
Here.
Hardy?
Here.
Henson?
Here.
Joseph?
Present.
McFarland? McFarland? Mooney?
Here.
Overdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Payne?
Here.
Roth? Roth? C. Smith?
Here.
D. Smith?
Here.
Stevenson?
Here.
Toledo? Woodson, excused. Zika?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Brenda. I want to remind everyone that the House has implemented detailed procedures designed to make our meeting safer during the present time. Please make sure your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or placed in mute. And if you have a laptop, please be sure the sound is turned off. And I guess that's usually for our audience, but as you can see with our new procedures, that pertains mainly to us members on the item. Good afternoon, members. I want to welcome you to the State Affairs Committee. Before we get started with today's agenda, I'd like to take a moment to introduce Vice Chair Payne. Chair Payne, thank you so much for being part of our committee. And would you like to say a couple words?
Thank you, Chair Masullo. Honored to be on the committee with you. And members, this is a great committee. I think you'll get a lot of pleasure out of what we hear in this committee this year. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I also would like to recognize Ranking Member Carlos Smith. Rep. Smith, it's an honor to have you serving with us, and I look forward to some challenging and informative debates. And would you like to say a couple words?
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair, Doctor, and Representative Masullo. I'm looking forward to serving together on this committee. I know that there's a lot of very important issues that are going to come through state affairs, and I'm glad to be a part of this process where we can have a dialogue, a respectful dialogue around those issues with someone who I respect very much and call a friend. So thank you, Chair Masullo.
Thank you. And I also like to recognize our whip, Representative Toby Oberdorf. Toby, would you like to say a few words about some of your roles in the committee?
Well, thank you, Dr. Chair. It has been a fantastic time so far. I look forward to working with all of you and working across however I may. And if you all have questions, get in touch with me. If you all have comments, get in touch with me, and I'll have a couple comments back. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And of course, we have an amazing staff here in the State Affairs silo. First off, our policy director and chief is Heather Williamson. Heather, thank you so much for being here with us. Our committee attorney, Lance Toliver, is watching us via our Florida channel, I hope. And so, hello. And Brenda Jones is our administrative assistant over there on the far left end. And for future meetings, we'll also have Tori Denson joining us. I want to thank Speaker Sprouse for allowing me to have an opportunity to chair this committee. And I want to tell you, members, this has the potential to be the most important and exciting committee that you'll serve on this session. We don't always agree on everything, but one thing we do agree on is we're here to improve our state and make the lives better for Floridians. And the vehicle to effectuate those changes is government. Our committee has broad authority over government, and with that authority comes broad responsibility. We'll tackle several important issues, including transparency and accountability on how taxpayer money is spent, and we'll hear some of that today. We'll also look at climate change and how it affects sea level rises. And I can tell you there's a lot of predictions out there. And we say that we want to follow science, but oftentimes hypotheses, which are postulates of science, get accepted as dogma. And it's going to be incumbent on us to do the research, search facts, and do the best we can to craft policy that makes sense. We'll have reasonable debates. We'll follow decorum. We'll lay a foundation for others to build on. We won't solve all these problems this session. We won't solve them in the next session or even the next few. But it's important that the foundations that we lay are solid enough that where the people that come after us build, that they'll have a substantial structure that'll stand the test of time. And it won't be easy. And I can tell you, your opponents are not people across the aisle or sitting in the seats next to you. Our opponent in this process is ignorance, and we need to fight that as best we can. Lou Holtz said, "Show me someone who has accomplished something worthwhile, and I'll show you someone that has overcome adversity." All of us in our own lives have overcome adversity. Members, I consider you all leaders. And as leaders, your duty is to envision the future. But my hope is that through this process, that you will become great leaders. And a great leader not only envisions the future, they serve in such a way as to enable others to create it. So with that, let's get started. On November 17th, thank you. On November 17th, the speaker discussed the historical trends of privatization and state government functions and the creation of quasi-public entities. While the goal was to bring energy and innovation to the public sector to government, recent incidents have demonstrated the need for greater accountability. For example, last session, the committee known as the Public Integrity and Elections Committee discovered exorbitant compensation payouts for the executive leadership team of the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence. This discovery resulted in the governor issuing Executive Order 20-44 on February 20th, almost a year ago. In part, that order directed all the executive agencies to submit to the government a list of entities named in statute that the agency must form a sole source public-private agreement and a list of entities that, through contract or agreement, annually receive at least 50% of their budgets from state or federal funds. In addition, the government directed the agencies to obtain and review copies of the IRS Form 990 for each entity, showing total compensation for all the members of its executive leadership, and if the compensation exceeded federal or state limits, then the agency was directed to refer that matter to the Office of the Chief Inspector General. From the information submitted to the governor, we recently learned there is approximately 839 entities that meet the governor's criteria. Of those 839, approximately 165 were named in statute in association with sole source public-private agreements, and approximately 675 received at least 50% of their budget from state or federal funds. The total known state funding in the fiscal year was at least $3.9 billion, and the total federal funding was at least $3.4 billion. And of the 839 entities, only 169 appeared to have state and federal compensatory limits applicable to their executive leadership. And of those 169, 12 were noted to have excess compensation to their executive leadership, and I will note that 3 of the 12 returned their excess compensation to the appropriate governing entity. Members, these types of entities fall within the broad range of policy areas, from economic development to healthcare to education, and the list goes on. As stewards of the public funds, it is our responsibility to ensure that these entities not only are operating in an efficient manner, but they are not abusing their public trust. For this reason, I'm asking Chair Fischer and his staff to review the information collected by the governor's office. Members, the release of this information last night is timely in that it emphasizes the importance of our first meeting. I've also asked staff to provide a briefing on the recent investigations undertaken by the Public Integrity and Elections Committee. This briefing will provide insight into issues and procurements and misuse and waste of public funds and demonstrate the greater need for accountability and oversight. With that, I'd like to welcome Karen Mitz to the podium. She is director of the Office of Public Accountability, and for the past 4 years, Ms. Mitz has worked as staff attorney investigator from what was previously known as the Public Integrity and Ethics Committee. I've asked her to brief us on a few of the investigations undertaken by the committee since 2017. But please note, because some of these investigations are still active, Ms. Mitz will only be able to be discussing issues that will not jeopardize the integrity of any of those ongoing investigations. Ms. Mitz, you are now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, everybody. Again, my name is Corinne Mitz, and I am the director of the Office of Public Accountability.
Ms. Mitz, is your mic on?
Is my mic on? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, let me start over. So, thank you. Good afternoon, and my name is Corinne Mitz, and I am the director of the Office of Public Accountability. As the chairman just stated, I worked with the PI committee for the last 4 years, and we did a number of investigations, and I'm going to detail or summarize four of them for you today. I'd like to begin with the investigation involving Florida Polytechnic University and a vendor called Educational Management Services, LLC, which I will refer to as EMS. In 2017, concerns arose that EMS, which was owned by the wife of a lobbyist, may have been the intended beneficiary of certain appropriations to the state university system institutions, otherwise known as SUS universities, for the purchase of an anti-hazing course to be offered to college students. Questions arose as to how the contract was awarded to EMS, and PI staff was asked to investigate possible fraud or non-performance by EMS. 3 years earlier, in 2014, the General Appropriations Act included proviso, requiring UCF to procure an anti-hazing course for use throughout the state university system for a period of 3 years. EMS unsuccessfully bid that contract. After the three-year $970,000 contract was awarded to another vendor, EMS unsuccessfully challenged that award. The following year, in the budget, Florida Polytechnic was awarded or received $1.5 million to also provide an anti-hazing course to SUS universities. Florida Polytechnic chose to award the contract to EMS via a no-bid contract at a cost of $1 million. Although the vendor chosen by UCF would have provided the service at a lower cost. Florida Polytechnic's legislative lobbyist took the lead on the procurement, leaving the appearance that EMS was the intended recipient of the contract. In 2016, the contract with EMS was renewed by Florida Polytechnic. The university agreed to pay EMS $1 million each year, retaining the surplus $500,000. After the investigation, it was determined that EMS's anti-hazing course was turnkey and fully operational at the time of EMS's bids to both schools for use by all SUS universities, and that EMS's obligation under the contract with Florida Polytechnic were performed, albeit at a generously profitable price. PI committee staff found no evidence of fraud that EMS misrepresented its course or committed any fraud in submitting bid proposals to either university. However, as a result of the PI Committee's investigation, Florida Polytechnic terminated its contract with EMS and returned $800,000 to the state treasury. And the House made reforms to the appropriations process and instituted the House lobbyist issue disclosure. The next investigation occurred around the same time as the EMS investigation and involved Visit Florida, the state's tourism agency, and a vendor called Map Media LLC. This matter is unique in that it not only involved a committee investigation, which morphed into a House investigation, but also four court cases and ultimately an appellate decision in the House's favor. So let me start with some background. In 2015, Visit Florida entered into a contract with a private production company for the rapper Pitbull to act as a celebrity tourism ambassador or spokesperson for the state of Florida. In late 2016, before Visit Florida started publishing its contracts, the House demanded a copy of the pit bull contract from Visit Florida. Visit Florida initially resisted because the production company argued that the contract contained trade secret information and had to be kept confidential. Visit Florida ultimately provided a copy of the contract to the House, but not before the production company's attorney sent a letter advising it deemed the contract confidential as it contained trade secrets, that none of the material business terms should be disclosed to the media or elsewhere, and warning that it reserved the right against any individual violating its trade secret confidentiality claim. The attorney was able to do this because Visit Florida, in signing the contract, agreed to a stipulation that effectively prohibited it from releasing the entire contract. The House sued the production company, seeking a judgment, declaring that all House members and committee staff were immune from any civil liability for any disclosure of the material terms of the contract. 2 days later, however, Pitbull took to Twitter and disclosed the $1 million value of his contract. Because Visit Florida hadn't been publishing its contracts, there was no opportunity for public scrutiny until something like the Pitbull contract came to light. The House started asking questions, and Visit Florida started publishing its contracts online. High committee staff reviewed a number of contracts, which didn't cause any concern until we came across Visit Florida's contract with Map Media. From 2012 to 2016, Visit Florida contracted with Map Media for the production and broadcast of Emeralds Florida, a TV show featuring Florida cuisine, which cost Visit Florida approximately $12 million. This was done without the benefit of competitive bidding because of an exemption from Chapter 287. Thus, Visit Florida did not vet potential vendors for prior film experience, film production experience, or for the best value. While Map Media appeared to have fully performed under the contracts to the satisfaction of Visit Florida, concerns arose about Visit Florida's procurement process and contract integrity, and in 2017, the PI Committee was asked to investigate. The contracts contemplated recruitment of local tourism development councils to sponsor episodes to be filmed in their areas, and also allowed Map Media to sell sponsorships, but only public dollars, $4 million of public dollars, paid for those sponsorships. After reviewing numerous documents provided by Visit Florida and interviewing witnesses, PI Committee staff learned that Visit Florida never inquired about Map Media's actual costs or its anticipated profits at the time it entered the contracts. So, staff sought records from Map Media to determine how much it profited from these contracts. Map Media refused to voluntarily produce the records, and ultimately the PI Committee issued subpoenas for them. The day before they were due, Map Media sued the committee, claiming, among other things, that the subpoenas violated Map Media's right to privacy. Speaker Corcoran, on behalf of the committee, countersued to enforce its subpoenas. Due to delays in judicial action, the House also issued identical subpoenas, which were then challenged in federal court. While most of the House subpoena was honored, the internal records of Map Media were withheld pending a state court ruling. At a later hearing before the circuit court, Visit Florida's former chief marketing officer testified that he and a group of others looked at the industry and what Map Media was seeking in compensation, and said, yeah, what Map Media is asking for is a fair price, without any inquiry into the cost of production or the amount of profits Map Media was expected to make. That same marketing officer also testified that he and the owner of Map Media were friends and had been before the first contract was ever negotiated. The contracts revealed that Map Media would receive a contract payment upon proof of benchmarks, such as production of or airing of episodes. Visit Florida took no interest in how Map Media spent public money. The contracts also revealed that in addition to receiving millions of dollars from Visit Florida, Map Media also retained ownership of the television show, allowing it to resell the show to others for additional compensation. If Visit Florida wanted to use it again, it would have to pay Map Media even more money. For certain years, Visit Florida paid Map Media greater sums upon unverified representations that production and airing would cost more. Despite these concerns, supported by court testimony, the circuit court refused to enforce the portion of the House subpoena seeking records of Map Media's expenses and profits. After an appeal that took 2 years, the First District Court of Appeal upheld the House's authority to review such records in conducting oversight of public spending. This past summer, staff received and fully analyzed the costs and profits derived from the public contracts. The PI Committee will be hearing further on this investigation in the coming days. But I can tell you that as a result of the PI Committee shining the light on the contracts between Visit Florida and MAP Media, the public was made aware of just how much money MAP Media was paid and the efforts it went to hide the amount of profit it made. Visit Florida ceased contracting with MAP Media. The House unanimously passed House Bill 7073 to reform procurement and contracting by state agencies, but the bill was not considered by the Senate. And finally, as a result of both the EMS and MAP Media investigations, profits earned from state contracts are no longer secret. The third investigation I'd like to highlight for you involves the University of Central Florida. In 2018, as a result of findings by the Auditor General that UCF used $38 million of Education in General, or ENG funds, carry forward funds, for construction of a new academic building in violation of both state statute and Board of Governors BOG regulation, the PI Committee was asked to investigate. ENG funds were to be used for operating activities, such as general instruction, plan operations and management, and student services, in budgets approved by the University Board of Trustees. To discourage unnecessary spending, universities were allowed to retain unspent ENG funds left over at the end of a fiscal year, it's known as ENG carry-forward funds, but only to be used for the same purpose ENG funds were used. ENG funds and carry-forward funds could not be used for fixed capital outlay. After the BOG informed the House of the pending audit findings, Speaker Corcoran and Speaker Designate Oliva sought numerous records and evidence, including records of board and committee meetings. House staff interviewed witnesses and ultimately deposed 13 university employees and board members. Staff learned that UCF had made a transfer of an additional $46.5 million of ENG funds, for various construction projects, including $13.8 million that had already been spent, for a total of approximately $85 million transferred and $51.8 million spent. These transfers occurred between 2013 and 2018, when UCF was experiencing rapid growth. Other findings of the investigation included, despite the pretense of an internal investigation, university officers hid from the Board of Trustees the full misdirection of funds. Compliance activities of the university were inadequate to identify the misspending. UCF's Board of Trustees lacked training and information necessary to fulfill their fiduciary responsibilities, and the Board of Governors' limited oversight resources contributed to UCF's misspending. And finally, the last investigation began a year ago and remains an active investigation. It involves the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence. As background, in 2012, the legislature amended a statute to require DCF to contract only with the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence, a nonprofit, to monitor, evaluate, and fund the state's 42 domestic violence shelters. This had the unintended consequence of leaving DCF powerless to competitively procure the contract, to find the best provider, and with little negotiating power to ensure faithful performance. With increasing frequency through the years, questions were raised about the CEO's compensation reported on the coalition's IRS Form 990s, the federal return filed by nonprofits. In late 2019, the House learned that the coalition was stonewalling the DCF Inspector General's months-long effort to obtain records clarifying the CEO's compensation. It's important to note that the coalition's 2018 Form 990, which was the most recent one available at the time, reported total revenues of just under $52 million, with 99.75% of that being public funds. It's also important to note that federal agencies limit the amount of public funds used to compensate officers, but no actual state limitation exists unless the entity is a community-based care organization, which the coalition was not. Speaker Oliva directed the PI Committee to monitor the dispute between coalition and DCF's Inspector General. The coalition's CEO retired in November of 2019, And when a former legislator was announced as interim CEO, the House believed the matter would be quickly resolved. However, the interim CEO resigned after the board and officers continued to withhold the information sought by DCF. Chair Leak then instituted a full investigation, including a demand for records, which led to depositions and live testimony before the committee over a three-week period. Testimony elicited at the public hearings established that the CEO, assisted by the CFO, determined the maximum amount of public funds that could be funneled to executive bonuses at the end of each fiscal year. Beginning in 2014, they engaged the Compensation Committee, also known as the Executive Committee, of the Coalition Board in a scheme to award the maximum amount as outrageous bonuses, mostly in the form of cashable paid time off or PTO. The CEO also gifted the CFO and the COO cashable PTO. PTO expenditures sat in the coalition accounts until executives chose to cash them out. And the coalition did not publicly report PTO as compensation to the employee until it showed up on the IRS Form 990 as much as 22 months after such leave was cashed out. Thus, both the public and the coalition board members who were not on the executive committee were kept in the dark about executive compensation and the true financial health of the organization. Staff has reviewed hundreds of thousands of pages of records produced by the coalition, DCF, the Inspector General, and individual board members. At the House's urging, the Attorney General initiated a receivership under judicial supervision to dissolve the coalition and recover wasted public funds. DCF filed fraud claims in circuit court against the coalition and the individuals responsible. And during last session, the legislature stripped the coalition of its statutory monopoly, and DCF reorganized the funding and accountability process. This investigation remains ongoing, the House having employed a forensic accounting firm to discover how the coalition charged its misspending and how they hid it so long. To date, we have made the following findings. Excuse me. During her last 3 years of her employment with the coalition, the CEO received over $5 million in total compensation. The House believes that the CEO may have received as much as $7.5 million in excess compensation during her last 10 years, and we assume all of that was from public funds. The coalition hid the CEO's multi-million dollar accrued leave balance in larger liability lines on both audited financial statements and IRS Form 990s. Other deferred compensation was reported separately from total individual compensation, compounding the misrepresentations. Again, the coalition's board of trustees lacked training and information necessary to fulfill their fiduciary responsibilities. The composition of the coalition's executive committee responsible for the CEO's compensation did not change for at least 10 years. The CEO developed close and beneficial friendships with members serving on the executive committee. The executive committee never inquired as to the value of the CEO's ever-growing PTO balance. In November 2019, the coalition had to pay an excise tax in excess of $500,000 for the CEO's excess compensation in 2018. And it is clear that the coalition owed another excise tax on compensation received by the CEO during the 2019-2020 fiscal year. And finally, the coalition's outside audit firm and the actual CPA leading those audits also did not change for several years. The House, the Chief Inspector General, DCF, the receivership, and apparent criminal investigations are expected to continue for some months. The PI committee is expected to receive periodic reports on the investigation's progress. If anybody has any questions about the investigations I've highlighted, my door is open. I'm in 317 the Capitol, and I happen to share a suite with Don Rubottom, who is the staff director of PI with whom I conducted these investigations. We're both familiar with them. Excuse me, we both have access to the records, so I welcome you to swing by, make an appointment if you have any questions. And Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Mitz. Members, as you can see from these examples, as Ms. Mitz has so eloquently detailed the information that I shared with you at the beginning of our meeting, it's no small issue. And I want to continue to emphasize that as stewards of the public funds, it's our responsibility to ensure that these entities are not only operating in an efficient and, I'll say, effective manner, but they are not abusing the public trust. Chair Fisher, you're going to have a big task ahead of you, and we all look forward to the details that you'll be presenting to us in the near future. Because Ms. Mitz's investigations are still ongoing, the questions we'll have her answer, if you have any, will be directed to her personally in her office. We have a few minutes left. Do any of the members have any comments? Okay, very good. Members, this concludes the agenda for our meeting. Once we adjourn, please leave through the door so the sergeant can prepare the room. And seeing there's no further business before us, Representative Hardy, move we rise, and without objection, we are adjourned. Thank you.